Network Europe, a program from Radio E, a partnership of Europe's international broadcasters.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Network Europe. I'm Barbara Gruber. Coming up on the programme, why the European Commission gave Romania and Bulgaria a red card and a green light on EU accession this week. We'll head to Slovenia as the country prepares to change the toller for the euro. And is Europe getting into the Da Vinci mood? Those stories and more coming up on the programme. Are Bulgaria and Romania joining the European Union in 2007, or will they have to wait another year? This week, the two countries got an answer from the European Commission. Well, sort of.
The possibility of being ready in 2007 is doable, but it is for the two countries to take decisive actions. At the same time, the European Union needs to deliver a clear signal that it stands ready to honour its commitments.
José Manuel Barroso, the President of the European Commission, presenting the eagerly awaited EU progress reports on Bulgaria and Romania. The report said both countries can join the Union next year, provided they implement reforms in a number of areas. Now they have 5 more months to show that they're really committed to fight corruption and crime and to reform their administrations. Failure to reform could lead to a delay of their entry, the loss of hundreds of millions of euros in subsidies, and maybe even a political backlash in Western European countries, as it's an open secret that many Europeans are tired of EU enlargement.
My opinion about the expansion of the European Union is that it went a hell of too quick, and I think it would have been more sensible to concentrate on the former national state beforehand and not expand the European Union up to 25 members and even more.
Well, I think there are a lot of problems considering different cultures and different national identities, I guess. But all in all, it's great because it has a lot of opportunities to it.
European Union is big enough at this point, and it should be ending with getting one state like Bulgaria, Romania.
The expansion of the European Union, yeah, I think it's a good thing. There might be a problem in general in Germany that for most people, countries like Bulgaria are far away. So and they don't really know much about these countries, and so they're uncertain what kind of country will become part of the European Union. Things get less familiar as more and more countries join.
Voices from the street here in Germany showing how controversial the issue of EU enlargement still is throughout the continent. No real surprise then that the European Commission was reluctant to give Bulgaria and Romania a green light without also sending out a strong warning. Back in 2002, Bulgaria was the first to receive the label of viable market economy, 2 years ahead of its neighbour Romania. But now it's lagging behind. The sticking point is corruption. Radio France International's Nick Champeau reports from Sofia.
The Commission's warnings obviously made the headlines in the capital, Sofia. The next item in this Bulgarian radio news bulletin was, incidentally, about corruption. The head of the capital's central heating company is mired in controversy because he allegedly purchased expensive sports cars with company money. Such practices often go unpunished in Bulgaria, either because there is no will or because evidence is lost and procedures are slow. Brussels says this has to stop. Boris Belchev was appointed Attorney General in February 2006. He knows he has a lot on his plate.
Obviously, we have to identify the connections between organized crime groups and members of the judiciary and make sure that those members of the judiciary are sent to jail where they belong. It is a job that has been neglected for many years. This is a problem in Bulgarian society, that there was this perception that some people are above the law. And we wanted to make sure that nobody has this feeling anymore. So at any time, when we have enough grounds to bring charges against a member of parliament, we'll be certainly asking for his immunity.
Velchev asked for the immunity of 8 members of parliament to be lifted. He argues Sofia did not wait for the EU warnings before taking action. A new law on political party funding was passed, the crime procedures code was thoroughly amended, and extra high-level investigators were appointed. But unlike its neighbor, Romania, Bulgaria has failed to convict top politicians, and it has yet to put authors of mafia-style contracts track killings behind bars. In its report, the EU calls for tangible results by the autumn. Boris Velchev, it seems, has not read the warnings carefully.
I'm quite aware that for many years, for 15 years, we have had a number of contract killings that have been left unsolved, which is a problem for us. But I think that the European Union and our colleagues in Brussels do not expect us to make miracles. There is absolutely no possibility in a country where the rule of law is a main principle to be able to ensure convictions within a few months' time.
Katia Christova is head of the Bulgarian branch of Transparency International. She says Bulgaria's judiciary is still struggling with its communist past and that reforming that sector was never Sofia's priority.
What we have done at the first point in Bulgaria was the construction of new political institutions. Then we had to tackle with the problem with the transition to a market economy. Then we had to tackle with the problem of privatization of state assets, etc., etc. And the judicial system stayed somehow out of those efforts of getting a much more accountable government at all level and within all its branches.
Brussels obviously takes the issue of corruption seriously, but such close monitoring of an EU candidate is unprecedented in enlargement history. Commentators say it has a lot to do with growing unease in Western Europe about further EU expansion. If these standards are not met, Bulgaria risks delayed entry. This means that because individuals take bribes, the country will be deprived of hundreds of millions of euros in subsidies. In the streets of Sofia, people on low wages rely on the funding to improve their living standards. In the meantime, they have to take two or three jobs to make ends meet. Those who can afford to go to university. This group of students at the new Bulgarian university outside the capital believes that new generations will change the country's attitude towards corruption.
You have a problem, and there is a path that you should go through to solve a problem. So people, they are not willing to take the path because they think it's not secure to take the path.
Bribes are more efficient than the normal path.
Yes, exactly.
It's a very big problem in Bulgaria, mainly because the people are very unconscious about that the whole society goes wrong if they take some bribe.
Here in our university, there's no corruption because there are rules. No one is asking for you to give money to have your exams. It's a model for establishing a mechanism in the whole society.
Politicians in Sofia have 4 months to roll up their sleeves and convince people to choose the right path. Or else corruption will remain part of the country's folklore, a folklore that is not to the taste of commissioners in Brussels. Nick Champeau, RFI, Sofia.
Corruption and organized crime, as we just heard, are Bulgaria's and the European Commission's biggest headache. Romania still needs to prove that its recent crackdown on corruption and crime is irreversible. But the four red flags it received from the European Commission were all in technical areas such as agriculture. Julian Morrison reports from Bucharest.
The news that the European Commission monitoring report does not clearly recommend January 1, 2007 as Romania's accession date was received quite well in Bucharest, though it could have been regarded as a bit of a disappointment, given the very positive appreciations received by Romania of late. But the Romanian authorities read the message in a mature way. Prime Minister Călin Popescu-Tăriceanu.
Our discussions have confirmed the fact that Romania's accession on January 1, 2007 is doable. It is a realistic assessment. The report of the Commission is correct and objective, and it reconfirms the progress made by Romania.
The next day after the presentation of the European Commission monitoring report on Romania and Bulgaria, the Commission President, José Manuel Barroso, and Commissioner for Enlargement, Olli Rehn, travelled first to Bucharest, then to Sofia, to talk to the two countries' officials. In Bucharest, José Manuel Barroso delivered a message of congratulation and confidence.
Romania has delivered clear results during the last 6 months. We have to give credit where it is due. I congratulate you for this. You should be able to reach the finishing line on the 1st of January 2007, provided the identified shortcomings are overcome, especially in the reform of judiciary and fight against corruption. It is time now to roll up the shirt sleeves and deliver the last effort. I'm afraid this may shorten the summer holidays for some in the public administration, but believe me, it's worth doing it.
Indeed, there is a lot of work lying ahead, and not just in such areas of serious concern as the reform of the judiciary and corruption, but also in agriculture. The great progress made by Romania since the last monitoring report translates into Bucharest having managed to reduce the number of so-called red flags from 14 to 4. Of these 4 remaining red flags, 3 are in the field of agriculture. To find out what Romania still needs to do to get rid of these red flags, I talked to Dacian Cioloș, who is an advisor to the Ministry of Agriculture in charge with European affairs. The 3 pending issues in agriculture, he says, are the paying agencies, which make the direct payments to farmland owners, the Integration Administration and Control System, IACS, and food safety.
We are rather optimistic even for these 3 items because regarding the paying agencies and IACS system, we had some real and important progress in these last months. On paying and intervention agency, in 2005 we started with only 16 staff, and now we have 3,600 staff recruited. And until September, we will finalize the recruitment for all 5,000 staff for these agencies.
But despite the huge volume of work, Dacian Cioloș is optimistic that Romania will be ready for entry into the EU in 2007. Actually, it will be better prepared than the 10 countries that joined in 2004.
6 months before accession, Poland had 6 red flags on agriculture. And Hungary had 5, including paying agencies and IACS. So they are not specific for Romania. It is normally because in this area the new member states have a lot of work to do.
So optimism is the dominant note in Bucharest. Accession in January 2007 is a realistic, achievable objective. In the coming days, Romanian and European experts will sit down and look at what Romania needs to do in concrete terms to be ready for accession on the 1st of January 2007.
Iulian Morisan from Radio Romania International reporting from Bucharest. And while most of the attention this week focused on Romania and Bulgaria, 2 new EU members, Slovenia and Lithuania, were waiting for a green light from the European Commission to join the Eurozone. The European Commission rejected Lithuania's application to join the single currency, saying the country's inflation was too high. But Slovenia was recommended to join the club, a first for an Eastern European country. The former Yugoslav Republic has long been a star economic performer in the region and will become the 13th country to adopt the euro. Joining me on the line from Slovenia is Michael Manske from Radio Slovenia International. Michael, changing the tola to the euro, how has the decision of the European Commission been greeted in Slovenia this week?
Well, it was certainly good news, and it was certainly greeted well, but it wasn't much of a surprise. Slovenia has been meeting all the criteria for Eurozone membership since last year, and the central bank has always been very confident that Slovenia would make it.
So no big parties on the streets?
No big parties. It was kind of expected.
Is there a particular sense of pride for being the first new EU country to adopt the single currency?
Well, I think so. I mean, if you look around at this neighborhood, the former Yugoslavia, Slovenia certainly stands out as a model example. You know, the other Yugoslav republics are still recovering from the war. Some of them are many, many years away from EU membership. And then you have little Slovenia, you know, integrating well and prospering. So it's definitely a source of pride for people here.
Now, introducing the euro may also lead to increasing prices, as it has in the past, as the euro was introduced in 2002. Are Slovenians worried about life becoming more expensive?
Very much so, very much so. A poll taken last year showed that about 60% of Slovenes, so the majority, thought that the euro would have more negative consequences than positive ones. So, and of course, they're influenced by a lot of the reports that are coming from Western Europe saying that everything is more expensive now. You know, Germans calling it the Teuro and so on. However, there's no serious opposition to adopting it. You know, it's just seen more as a hurdle that, you know, has to be jumped.
And looking at the positive consequences, what consequences will the introduction of the euro have for Slovenia, especially in the field of tourism and foreign investment?
Slovenia has certainly lagged behind in foreign direct investment, but the problem there is more about bureaucratic problems. So I'm sure introducing the euro won't hurt there, and it's certainly hoped by people here that having the euro will draw in more day tourists. You know, keep in mind Slovenia borders two countries that already have the euro, that's Italy and Austria, and I'm sure people there may be more inclined to come for, say, the weekend if they know they can spend their euros here.
But there is no direct correlation or figures that show that introducing the euro will definitely boost tourism.
There's no definite figures that I'm aware of.
Mm-hmm. Slovenia will enter the eurozone alone next year because Lithuania was rejected for the time being. Mm-hmm. But it's very likely to be followed by successive waves of many new mm-hmm. EU countries. What lessons do you think can be drawn from Slovenia's experience for the other countries?
Well, I think Slovenia's lesson is that slow and steady wins the race. You know, unlike a lot of other Eastern European countries, Slovenia didn't go through any, you know, shock therapy or massive selling off of state assets. Instead, it kind of concentrated on slowly repairing its economy, shifting its markets from the former Yugoslavia to Western Europe, and kind of doing what needed to be done. So, you know, they kept the deficit down, they kept public debt down, and they fought really hard to keep inflation under control. And all this time, they were resisting a lot of the advice coming from the West, and basically were saying, you know, no, let's do this slow, and let's do it right.
Michael Manske there, speaking to us from the Radio Slovenia International Studios in Maribor. In May 2004, as 10 new members joined the European Union, Ireland, the United Kingdom and Sweden were the only countries to immediately open up their labour markets to the new EU citizens. Since then, according to Ireland's official figures, around 10,000 Czechs have taken advantage of that opportunity to work there. Now, drawing on 2 years of experience, the Irish government has just launched an information campaign entitled Know Before You Go. Radio Prague's Dita Siedu reports from the Czech capital.
Irsko se svým prosperujícím hospodářstvím a stále více mnohonárodnostní společností se stalo oblíbenou cílovou zemí evropských pracujících.
A DVD in Czech with English subtitles, as well as leaflets, booklets and posters, which will be available through public employment offices, are meant to prepare job seekers for employment in Ireland. They explain various legal things you need to know before you arrive, everything from opening bank accounts to taxes and accommodation. Donald Sands, who is Assistant Director General of the Irish Training and Employment Authority, has come to Prague to launch the campaign. He says it was not motivated by problems with migrant workers, but quite the opposite.
No difficulties. I think the reason we're launching this campaign is that we have a greater appetite for more people who might be interested in working. We are delighted with our fellow workers from other European member states. They have made a huge contribution to Irish life, and they have brought in a whole multi-ethnic culture, which I think we've all benefited from.
The Czech Labour and Social Affairs Ministry is cooperating with the Irish authority in distributing the materials around the country. Deputy Minister Eva Šmejkalová.
Currently, there are around 10,000 Czechs working in Ireland and some 15,000 Czechs in the United Kingdom. The figures may seem small, but that's only until we get used to traveling in order to find work. Young people find no difficulty in it. They are quite spontaneously joining the labour markets in English-speaking countries. It is more of a problem with older people who are more conservative. Looking for jobs only in the area they live in is an obstacle to their personal growth. I believe it will be our task to change that in the future.
Radio Prague's Dita Asiedo with this report on European open markets. And this week's political debates in Europe have somehow taken second place to the real headline, namely the eagerly awaited world premiere of The Da Vinci Code at the Cannes Film Festival on Wednesday. Despite thumbs down from critics, no one doubts that it will be a huge success. The Da Vinci Code by Dan Brown has indeed sold more than 39 million copies. Some of the book's most dramatic scenes take place in London, and there's so much interest in the various locations that the tour company, London Walks, is offering a special Da Vinci Code tour. Don McGillivray joined one this week.
On a grey day in central London, mid-afternoon, about 45 Da Vinci devotees gather in a light rain. They've read the book, now they're going to see the sights, visit the actual locations where Robert Langdon and Sophie Nevo stopped to study the clues.
We are walking through areas of London where the action in the book takes place, so we will be talking about the areas as well as the book.
Tour guide Tom Hooper, the man with a strong voice and a head full of information, leads the way. Most of these enthusiasts are from Europe. There's a handful of Americans, one Canadian, a smattering of Australians, there's even a couple of Londoners. The first stop, the Round Templar Church.
As far as the characters in the book are concerned, they enter by a door which is just round here on the right. In the book, they think they're in the crypt because they go downstairs. There is no crypt in this church. And they talk of a missing figure on the ground. There isn't a missing figure. But the figures on the ground are very important to look at because they will transport your imagination back to the Knights Templars because they've got the right uniform on. Broad swords and a wonderful shield.
Just a 3-minute walk from the church sits one of the most important Da Vinci Code locations. It's not in the book, but it has a huge significance for author Dan Brown. This is the Royal Courts of Justice. Last month, in one of these rooms, Mr. Justice Peter Smith ruled that Brown was innocent of charges, that he stole his plot from a book published in 1983 called The Holy Blood and the Holy Grail. The characters ran past this court building as they escaped from the Templar Church.
And it was along this stretch, of course, that the characters Robert and Sophie rushed as fast as they can after they realised that the Temple Church was merely an ambush and a dead end for them. And they then catch the tube to Westminster to go to the Institute in Systematic Theology. We're now going to take this extraordinary journey along the underground, and the one thing you're not going to do, which the characters do in the book, is to jump over the turnstiles.
On the tube heading to Westminster Abbey, some of the group talk about the tour.
I think it actually focuses on the fact that it's fiction based in history, so it does, you know, it does put it in context, I think.
Well, I think it's interesting that he's telling it with a slight tongue-in-cheek. I think some people maybe take it too seriously.
The next station is Westminster. Change for the Jubilee line. Please mind the gap.
Out of the underground, past Big Ben, then down the street to one of the most famous buildings in the world, Westminster Abbey.
When you go inside, the characters in the book use the same entrance, and when they eventually have a tour of the Abbey, which is quite interesting in the book, they find a little note that lures them to the chapter house on the other side of the building.
The characters in this book were able to visit the Abbey, but the same characters in the movie were barred at the gate. Abbey officials refused permission to film. Despite the damp weather, the Da Vinci aficionados are enjoying the tour. They say seeing the actual sites where the heroes followed the clues through London helps bring the book alive.
Thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Don McGillivray, Deutsche Welle Radio, London.
And with the Da Vinci aficionados, we are wrapping up Network Europe this week. The program is produced with support from the European Union and is a partnership of Radio France International, Radio Sweden, Radio Polonia, Radio Netherlands, Radio Romania International, Slovak Radio, Radio Prague, Radio Slovenia International, Radio Ukraine and Deutsche Welle. On behalf of our pan-European team, I'm Barbara Gruber. Thanks for tuning in.